Welcome to Madlit Musings, the podcast where we dive into the minds of authors, exploring the profound realms of faith, social issues, and the delightful world of entertainment. I'm your host, Jamie Jill Wright, and on this literary journey, you never quite know what you're going to get. Hey there, Madlit enthusiasts. Our podcast is sponsored by the esteemed Baker Publishing Group. Whether you're into heartwarming romance, gripping suspense, or deep dives into matters of faith and society, Baker Publishing Group has it all. With Revell and Bethany House Publishers under their umbrella, they bring you a diverse array of books that will captivate your mind and stir your soul. Check out all of their line at www.bakerbookhouse.com. Hi, everyone. This is Jamie Jill Wright with Madlit Musings, and I have Sarah Loudon Thomas with me today.
Hi, hey, Sarah. Jamie.
We've already been chatting and almost forgot to push record, so I'm really glad we remembered that because we've been having way too much fun already. And for those of you watching on YouTube, Sarah's background is actually real. It's not a virtual Zoom background. So where are you right now, Sarah?
I am at the Mitford Museum. So I'm the director of Jan Karen's Mitford Museum. And this is the beautiful office that I get to work out of. I joke that the space you can't see in front of me with the computer and the paperwork on the desk is my office. And that back there is Jan's.
Well, I don't know. Jan had really good taste because that is a very
exceptional taste.
It's like everything's perfect. Like I'm looking at the frames and I'm like, wow, they're actually hung right. Like mine are just like, oh, nail, hang a picture. Oops.
Yeah, that's why I'm not turning the camera around.
Oh, fun. Well, that's got to be a fun job, just hanging out in quote Mitford, unquote.
Yeah.
That's so cool. But we are not here to talk about Jan Karen.
No.
We are here to talk about Sarah Loudon Thomas, who has a book coming out called These Tangled Threads. And it's kind of one of those things where when I found out you were writing about the Biltmore estate, I'm like, this just all falls into place. It makes sense.
Well, I worked at Biltmore for 6 years. So actually, it's funny. Every time I hear somebody say the Biltmore estate, I'm like, no, Biltmore. Right.
I'm from Wisconsin. Put a the in front of everything.
It's also funny because when I worked there, I was in public relations. And so I would, when media came in, Southern Living Magazine, Travel Channel, all those folks would come in to do pieces. I would be the person making sure that everything went smoothly and that they didn't touch anything.
Yes.
So a big part of my job was like, I actually had authority to unhook a velvet rope and take people into the rooms. I had to like call security on my CB radio and say, we are now entering the library. But then once we're in there, I had to be like, okay, don't step on the rugs. Don't touch anything. Hands behind your backs. Because it's all, you know, it's the collection.
Yeah, right.
And one of the head of the curatorial staff was telling me that one time she went to visit a friend in her home and was walking around all of the carpets. And her friend was like, what are you doing?
That's
like, it's okay. You can walk on my rugs.
Yeah, that's hilarious. You know, one of my grandmothers had some throw rugs that were, I don't know if they were old or what, but yet we were taught you not to walk on them. And I always grew up wondering why have a throw rug that you can't walk on because you eliminate 80%.
Maybe hang it. So it was a lot of fun working there. And my publisher came to me and said, hey, what do you think about a Biltmore story? And my first response was, have you read my book?
Right.
Because I write Appalachian historical, kind of the common everyday people of Appalachia. I'm a seventh generation West Virginian, and my people did not live at Biltmore, but they might have worked there. So as I started thinking about it, I was like, well, how can I take Biltmore and kind of attach that to my Appalachian themes? And Biltmore Estate Industries was an area that I had always been really interested in and loved learning about while I was there. George and Edith Vanderbilt were very civic minded and were very supportive of the local community. And so Biltmore Estate Industries, there two missionaries came to Asheville and they started this program teaching things like wood carving and weaving and housekeeping to the young people of Appalachia. And George and Edith were very involved in that. Some beautiful furniture came out of it, and this great homespun fabric. And I was like, that's my story. That's where I can tie in Biltmore and the Vanderbilts' outreach to the community. And it just happens that the book is releasing in April 2024, and Cornelia Vanderbilt got married in April 1924. So my
That's
weaver is making, she's making a fabric that's going to be a gift for Cornelia's wedding, and she doesn't have the creativity to do it and kind of does some unethical things, and there you go.
I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. So the book is, I'll just read the back cover real quick so people can get the gist of it rather than say, tell us what the book's about too.
Yeah,
So
thank you.
yeah, no problem. So it says 7 years ago, a hidden betrayal scattered three young friends living in the shadow of the great Vanderbilt mansion. Now, when Biltmore Industries master weaver Lorna Blankenship is commissioned to create an original design for Cornelia Vanderbilt's 1924 wedding, she panics, knowing she doesn't have the creativity needed. But there's an elusive artisan in the Blue Ridge Mountains who could save her if only she knew where to begin. To track down the mysterious weaver, Lorna sees no other way than to seek out the relationships she abandoned in shame. As she pulls at each tangled thread from her past, Lorna is forced to confront the wounds and regrets of life long ago. She'll have to risk the job that shapes her identity, as well as the hope of friendship and love restored. Ah. I
It
need to.
sounds really good when you read it.
Oh. I'm trying to pronounce each word very carefully. That sounds so good. Okay, so I have a question. The Vanderbilts. I have heard, and I don't know if this is true, but even with Biltmore Estates, notice I dropped the. With Biltmore Estates, that there's certain things that you have to get permission to reference and write about. Am I wrong or right when I say that? Like,
Well, a lot, most of it, the history is public domain. They do have a pretty strict policy about not endorsing. So like,
okay.
I contacted some of the folks I knew there and asked some questions, but none of them can come out and say, "Hey, buy Sarah's book. It's great."
Got
It's,
it.
part of what they do. There's so many people who would like to take that popularity and that celebrity and benefit from it. So that's kind of where the line is drawn. But I actually did, I do did have an endorsement from Kathy Barnhart, who is
Okay.
a retired member of the Biltmore staff. She was the floral displays manager for like 30 plus years, which means Christmas at Biltmore Estate, she was in charge. Like
Oh.
all of the decorations and the design and the just how, if you have been, if you want to go to Biltmore one time, go at Christmas. And I'll tell you a little secret. So the trick, it's pricey to
Oh,
go. But they do candlelight and it's just magical because the
sure.
fireplaces are burning, there are can of course it's artificial candles and things because you can't have open flame and
That could be
next to a
difficult.
14th century tapestry. But what you do is you get the very last timed entry before candlelight starts, and you get to watch the staff lighting the house,
Oh
lighting the
my God.
candles, lighting the fireplaces, and it is it's fairy tale. It's just such a gorgeous time. And Kathy was the person who did that. I always said that if I ever left Biltmore and were to come back, I would want to be on the floral displays staff because it's just so much fun. At Christmas, everybody helps. It doesn't matter what department you're in, you help set up with Christmas. And it starts in October, goes through January. They're doing Christmas in May because
Yeah.
they're getting everything ready.
Oh, yeah.
And so I worked from fluffing Christmas trees, which is super fun,
Yes.
making all the fake Christmas trees full and gorgeous, to my last year at Biltmore. I was allowed to decorate the tree in Mr. Vanderbilt's room. Now, I didn't get to design it. They said, here's the design, here's the decor, but I got to hang the decorations. And I was like, I
That's
have
exciting.
reached the peak of the pinnacle of Biltmoredom.
That is okay. There's no shame in that. There is really no shame in that at all.
Yeah,
That's amazing.
and I'm shameless about bragging about it. Like,
No,
oh, I
I
decorated a
brag away.
tree in Biltmore House.
There was a woman in my hometown when I was, oh, probably 13 or 14. And she lived in just a Victorian house. It definitely was not Biltmore Estate, but it was a Victorian house. And she did that where she, from attic to basement, every square inch, and she believed in the full on stuff every
Yeah.
pocket with something. And she would hire me and pay me to come in. And she wanted me to use, I got to do it whatever I wanted. She would pull out boxes and crates of old vintage. And it was just, here's your first room, go for it. And then she would come in and she'd be like, oh, let's move this here. Let's do this. But she did it in a way it wasn't critical. It was like just the finishing touches. And oh, it was such a fun experience on just such a small scale. I cannot imagine Biltmore.
Did she hire you to help take it back down?
Yes, she did actually. That's how I learned how do you package vintage, vintage things very carefully because they're not.
When you write historical fiction and you get to do historical things, it's just the best.
It is. I totally agree. Okay, so back to your book though. Now, so much of the books that I read with the Biltmore is really about the elitist and the wealthy. And so you're writing from a different perspective. So take us a little bit into that
Yeah,
arena.
the Lorna is really my main character, and she is a master weaver with Biltmore Industries. And it was originally Biltmore Estate Industries when it was part of the Vanderbilt, when they were sponsoring it. But eventually, after George Vanderbilt died, Edith sold the business to Grove Park Inn, to the gentleman who owned Grove Park Inn. And it became Biltmore Industries. They dropped the estate. And so she is a master weaver, and she's training other weavers, and she ends up training Gentry, who is basically an orphan who's been, her grandfather just kind of dumps her here because he wants to be rid of her. And she's traumatized, and she's wild, and she's incredibly creative, but she doesn't have the ability to just sit down and focus and do the weaving because it's so meticulous. I read so much about how to weave, and oh my gosh, weaving, I mean, it's a beautiful art, but setting the loom is such a meticulous, drawn out process. It takes so much time to set it up correctly so that you end up with a beautiful piece of fabric. And of course, Gentry does not have the patience for that. And then Arthur is a little bit older, and he has been in the woodworking side of things and eventually has his own woodworking shop. But there's a little romance between Lorna and Arthur, and then he's sort of this the cushion between these two grating personalities. And all three of the characters have been orphaned in some way, so they're dealing with how to live life
And
having
process.
suffered that trauma.
That's exciting. Okay, so the weaving part is that when I'm picturing weaving, my brain goes in two separate directions. One, I picture like more of the coarse, like I'm weaving a parka or a poncho. And then the other side of me is like I'm weaving lace or something like that. So what types of things would she be weaving in your novel?
So Biltmore Industries really did, if you go to the Folk Art Center in Asheville and you look at the woven items, you're likely to see things that are, they'll have a little bit of nubby pattern to them. They'll have some texture. Biltmore Industries was weaving fine cloth. And they did a variety of things, including the homespun, but like Calvin Coolidge, there was Coolidge gray. So the gray material that would make his suit that finely woven fabric. So it wasn't just the kind of rustic Appalachian mountain weaving that I think a lot of people picture and a lot of home weavers probably do, but it was also like fine, high quality manufactured. And at one point they were providing a huge amount of fabric up and down the East Coast. And Edith Vanderbilt wore Biltmore homespun. She went to speak to the North Carolina legislature, She was the head of the agricultural society at the time, and first woman president. And she wore Biltmore homespun to this event. And she said, I don't see if I can get this right, that her speech, someone had told her that her speech should be like a modern woman's skirt, long enough to cover the subject, but short enough to draw attention.
Oh my goodness.
And she had all those men and stitches and was just highly respected by the Agricultural Society. So I love taking those kinds of true stories and weaving them
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
into my fiction.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool. I love that. That's great. I'm glad that you explained the weaving part though, because I guess I don't think about like how my fabric is made, right? I just assume it's just you dig it up from under a tree or something, and then there's a bolt of fabric and you make a
If
sweatshirt.
you're wearing cloth, it probably was woven. It was probably woven on a machine. But,
Right.
once upon a time, even really fine, silk fabric is woven. So,
Wow. Oh, I have a new appreciation for fabric now. That's great. Okay, so there's also an element of faith that you're weaving through their story. So take us a little bit into that faith journey that your characters are on.
Well, all of my characters feel abandoned in some way, and I have a background in youth ministry. I spent 16 years with a children's home working with kids who had been abused, abandoned, neglected, and so all three of these characters have suffered that loss. Arthur's parents basically were unable to care for him and shifted him off on the church. So he was raised by a pastor who brought him to Asheville. Gentry's parents, she believes they're dead. We'll leave it at that. So Gentry is an orphan. Lorna loses both of her parents in pretty traumatic ways. Her mother dies of a sudden illness, and her father dies. There was a terrible flood in 1916 that put the gatehouse of Biltmore Estate. If you ever go to Biltmore Estate and you drive through that gatehouse, the gatehouse was almost underwater, is how high this flood water was. And there was I read an account of a 17, 18-year-old girl who she and her father tried to escape the floodwaters and were caught and were clinging to a tree, and he was swept away. While she was left there. So I give that account. All three characters come back to this day of this flood, which is kind of a turning point for everyone. And I wrote the account of her in that flood really based very closely on that true historical account of a girl who's, and there's just when as I was reading the story, and it's in the book, he's being swept away and he calls out, "Shucks, shucks." That's the last thing she hears her father say. And, having worked with kids who dealt with trauma, I thought, let's look at three different characters who all have this childhood trauma and look at how each one of them deals with it differently. Arthur becomes everybody's savior. He's going to take care of everybody. Lorna is trying to just basically, she's out for herself. She's like, how can I protect myself? And Gentry is this wild child who is acting out and can't has been unable to process what she's dealt with. So, all as we worked in ministry and we dealt with these kids, we really talked about how the only thing that will fix that kind of pain and trauma is Jesus. And you can try to fix it by yourself all day long, but you're not gonna. You have to find what's bigger than you, what's more than you, and to find that love that will heal all wounds. So by the end of the book, wounds are being healed.
Wounds are being healed. I love that. I love that. And that the title makes a lot of sense. I mean, outside of the weaving and the fabric and all that, but these tangled threads. When you look back at your life, it's interesting because right now I'm going through all of my parents' things now that my dad has moved into assisted living and my mom has passed away. And I on Saturday was so strange. It was like I was excited to go and let's go through stuff and get things accomplished. And by the middle of the afternoon, I was so exhausted, not because it was hard work, but it was the unraveling of lifetimes. And it was like the legacies of what was left behind. I mean, it wasn't just spoons in a drawer, but it was opening a drawer and then finding, a note or something that my mom had left on a post-it with the Bible verse. And then I found a tintype of my great great grandmother.
Oh.
And just all these things that you find tucked in little places, and you're like, they're threads that have woven your life that you don't even realize how it's formed you.
I kind of have this flipped experience. My father has passed away, and my mother is now in assisted living. But my dad had Parkinson's, and it wasn't like Alzheimer's where you just see the memory go and go. It was more, it muddled him, and it made him a different person. And so all these years that I was traveling back and forth to West Virginia to be part of his neurology appointments and to try to give him some consistency, and I'm loving my dad, and I'm dealing with my dad, and he's very different. About 24 hours after he passed away, there's the immediate, just overwhelming grief. About, once that first wave had passed, I began to grieve my real dad. Like, I had forgotten who my dad was before all of this happened. And yeah, that those it was it's like a woven tapestry that as you're weaving it, you can't see the pattern. And then at the end, you hold it up and you're like, oh my gosh, there's such beauty here. And these hard places and the difficulties, now I see how they're woven in together. And I was able to mourn my dad in a way that I was totally unexpected for me, because like the old dad, the dad who I remembered before Parkinson's, finally was returned to me in a way I never expected. So yeah, life is the tapestry, and I love that image. It's commonly used in sermons, and where God is weaving a tapestry, but we can only see the back. We see the knots and the mistakes and the hidden parts, and then one day we'll get to see the front, and we will be blown away.
I had a little taste of that last night too, because that tintype that I found of my great grandmother, I thought, oh, okay, I'm just going to go down the rabbit hole of ancestry.com. And so I typed it in and I found out she married, Emma married Joseph. So that was my great great grandfather. Well, then, of course, there's all these things that go back in genealogy. And I traced my great great grandfather all the way back to my 14th great great grandfather, who lived in England and was born 100 years before John Bunyan, who wrote Pilgrim's Progress, but he was born in the same town as John Bunyan. And then my ninth great grandfather, who was born 10 years before John Bunyan, at that point they had moved 90 miles north of John Bunyan. And I'm sitting here thinking, they could have been like neighbors to John Bunyan's grandparents and rubbed shoulders. Like all that, you see how threads kind of come together, and you're like, all of a sudden, you're rubbing shoulders potentially with, people that have impacted just faith in the world and legacy. It's crazy.
Everything is a coincidence, yet nothing is.
And then usually, I picture in my head too that, those dominoes where they stack them up and they're these, you hit the one and it just keeps moving. And by the time you get to the end, you're really focused on how that last one falls, but you don't go back to the beginning one and think that's the one that started it all.
When I was working at Biltmore and learning the history there, and George Vanderbilt coming into this, it was a very poor part of Appalachia. The land was in terrible condition. One of my favorite things about Biltmore Estate is that it preserved and rejuvenated a lot of land. But I would think about him coming in and buying up this property and building this chateau, a French chateau in the Appalachian Mountains,
Me
and
too.
just up the spine of Appalachia, there's my great grandmother, working in the garden and milking the cow and trying to get by, and like they're at the same time they're living in Appalachia, these completely different experiences. So I had always kind of had that picture, and that made it even more fun to write the story finally from that perspective.
So cool. I'm really excited about this book, and it's called These Tangled Threads. It's definitely going to be a different slant on the built, oh, sorry, on Biltmore State and its history. But I love that. I love that you can see it from a different angle. We can see it with the hints of Appalachia in it. Did I say that right? Appalachia.
You put a nice little turn on the end there. I kind of liked
Yeah,
it.
that was like the Wisconsin thing. I got to make sure I'm still from
As long as
Wisconsin.
you don't say Appalachia, I'm cool.
Right. I have been trained by people like you to
And
not.
Pepper Basham.
And Pepper Basham has like drilled it into me. Do not say Appalachian, Appalachian,
Yeah,
Appalachian.
that's your wine. Your wine is has an appellation.
Oh, okay. Good to know. All the things you learn here at Mad Lit Musings with Jamie Millwright and Sarah Loudon Thomas. But this book is coming out in April, and you can pre-order it right now. We'll be airing this, I think, a little bit before it's released. So get a copy from Baker Bookhouse because it's 40% off
Right.
and free shipping. So best deal on the internet. And any last words for us, Sarah, that we should know about this book or
You know, if you want to learn more about Appalachia, check out my website, saraloudenthomas.com. I have a newsletter sign up, and I love to share little tidbits about Appalachia. And I like I said, I'm the seventh generation, and my husband and I still own my family farm in West Virginia, which goes back to before the Civil War. And I just love sharing about what I think is the most beautiful place on the planet and finding these amazing stories about this amazing place.
Love it. Love it. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for being with us today. We could probably talk for another 3 hours, but we should probably get back to our daily lives.
Yeah, there's that whole making a living business to
Oh,
be
shucks.
done. Oh, shucks.
Oh, shucks. All right. So, everybody, go pick up these tangled threads. You won't regret it. And Sarah, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Head on over to YouTube where you can check out your favorite authors and yours truly as we chat up about books, about all the strange and weird subjects we like to talk about here at Mad Lit Musings. And you can even see our faces because it's video, because it's YouTube. So go check it out, Mad Lit Musings, right now. Are you still here? Go check it out. It's on YouTube. Thank you for joining Mad Lit Musings, where every conversation is a journey and every book is a new adventure. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast player or check us out on YouTube, and let's explore the fascinating intersection of faith, society, and storytelling together.